Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And today is February 3rd, 2018, where we are. And if it's February 3rd, 2018, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here today at 254-773-1400. Now, on to disclosures, disclaimers, etc., etc. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this riveting, and that's very painful,
riveting is very painful,
program.
Yes.
It's also the name of a SEC-registered investment advisory firm that resides in Salado, Texas, and does business in lots of places. And the stuff that we talk about on here, stuff being a technical term, is intended to be educational. It's not considered to be investment advice. Investment advice given to individuals based on their individual needs and preferences and fears and stuff like that. The information that we present on this radio program has been taken from or borrowed from or whatever. We've got it from sources we believe to be reliable and objective, and we do a lot of research on that, but we don't make any guarantee as to its absolute factual, well, I guess the factual nature is probably true, but its accuracy, because people do make mistakes sometimes. Anything else we need to say? I think we got it all.
I think close cover before striking is a pretty good thing to say on a regular basis.
Oh, yeah. And the Personal Wealth Coach is a fee-only fiduciary investment advisory firm.
Yes.
We don't take commissions, and we do our dead-level best not to have conflicts of interest, and we do the same thing on this radio program. If you'd like to give us a call, like I said, and ask questions, discuss things or whatever of these two old bald guys. Well, one old bald guy and one not so old bald guy.
Yeah. It's funny though that I get older every day.
I've noticed that. You're starting to get lines around the edge of your eyes. Did you know that?
I'm getting lines in my eyes?
No, around the edge.
Around
you're getting,
the edge.
You know, the smile lines that you...
When I should just stop smiling.
Yeah, that probably would help tremendously.
I'll just be scowling all the time. Then I'll get scowl lines. It'll be... No, not any better.
No, you don't want that. Anyway, give us a call in here at 254-773-1400 with any questions that you have.
We had an interesting week in the market.
We did?
Yeah. We had a week that had a...
Began with a Monday?
Yeah, began with a Monday and ended on a Friday market.
Yeah, Friday is always exciting.
And we had a big drop in the market this week.
Well,
but it took us back to almost 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, 4.1% in the Dow is a big drop. S&P 500, our beloved, dropped 3.31%. I mean, 3.85%, I'm sorry. Year to date, both of them are up a little over 3. Both of them are up over 20% for 1 year, so things are not bad. But... we have now gone, we still haven't hit the 5% down mark, and we have now gone 404 days, which is, I don't know that it's an all-time record, but it's certainly a record in recent history, with the Dow Jones and the S&P 500 going up more than down and not dropping more than 5% at any point. We are way the heck overdue for what is known in the market as a correction. A correction is not a bear market. It's just a bunch of people suddenly decide to sell for some
reason.
Yeah, take
some profits, scare everybody a little bit. It's good to be scared every once in a while with the market. You got to remember that it's not a smooth ride. If it were a smooth ride, we shouldn't expect the kind of returns that the market has had.
The last time we had anything noticeable on the downside was in 2015.
Yeah, we had a nice little correction in 2015.
But at least we had actually a couple of them, and one was over the fact that the Chinese economy was about to collapse, and the other one
which it didn't wind up doing.
No, it didn't. The other one was that oil was going to drop to $0 a barrel or something, and the world economy would collapse because of that. But at least there was something to be afraid of. You know, the Chinese economy is slowing down. Are they going into a recession? Are they going to collapse? or and my goodness gracious, the price of oil has dropped so far that a lot of people, a lot of companies are going to go out of business.
As we said at the time, the Chinese economy wasn't slowing down. It was just not growing as quickly. There's a difference.
Not in the eyes of a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people, they don't... Let's think about this. If you're doing your day-to-day activities and you're not changing, you're not exercising any more than you usually do, you're not eating anything different than you normally do, we would call that no growth. You're doing the same thing that you did last week. You're not being more productive, all of that stuff. That's no growth.
Well, now some of us who do the same thing week after week after week, when we get on the scale, we discover that there's more there than there was the week before, which is some growth.
That is growth in the wrong direction.
Oh, okay.
Okay. When we're talking about an economy, no growth is status quo. It's not good for the long term because a lot of countries are still having babies. You know, not the country itself.
Countries are having babies?
I hope they have babies in their country.
Yugoslavia had a bunch of babies.
They also have rusty razor blades.
Yes,
I believe those go together, actually.
Right.
Anyway, the Chinese economy had been and has been growing at this absurd rate for a very long period of time. Near double digits, and then slowly as they become more and more mature, it's dropped down into the single-digit growth rate. Now they're hovering in the 7% range. And in 2015, they dropped down to 6% growth, which if we had a 6% GDP growth, people would not be complaining about a slowdown in the economy. We would be saying this is three times our last year's average. And people were complaining in 2015 that the Chinese were about to hit a recession, which didn't get firmed up. There was no real evidence of it, but it was a good excuse to have a correction in the market. People look at me funny, look at you funny, I'm sure, when we say, I would really like to see a little correction right now. The reason why we've had a sustained bull market since 2009, is based on fear. As soon as that fear disappears from the market, then we can say goodbye eventually to the bull market. We need to have some respect. You can't just expect a positive, wonderful return every year. We had one amazingly good return in the markets last year and the year before. And people are getting used to that. These are the same people that said, never forget about the Great Recession. I think this kind of, I don't know if this is going to be the correction that's coming up here. In fact, I tend to think it isn't because so many people are saying this is it. Just looking at the headlines everywhere about it, but I could be wrong. It could be that this is the correction. I kind of hope it goes down 10% or so and then kind of settles out and gets all the people that shouldn't be in the market out of the market again. But it very well could be.
I mean, it's going to, for the traders, if it drops 10%, and you know, that means that's another basically 6% more than it dropped last week, the market suddenly becomes a bargain, and there's a lot of cash sitting on the sides waiting to jump in, and the discussion on Wall Street, at least according to the Wall Street Journal and Barron's, is that if this thing goes down 10%, I'm jumping in with both feet. So that's the difference, by the way. That's one of the differences between a correction and a bear market. A bear market will take us down a long ways. It's generally the market has become massively overpriced. We've run out of buyers. One of the things that's very significant is even though so far this year, given the short period of time we've had, 1 month, this 1 month, we've had some really good investor cash flow from small investors, but we certainly haven't seen the overwhelming investor cash flow come in that we saw like in the late 1990s or even in 2006 and 2007. Bear markets, the things that really can really hurt the value of your portfolio for several years, occur when there has been when everybody who's going to buy, or the vast majority of people who have been thinking about buying, have bought, and in many cases have not only bought but have borrowed money to buy some more. And we don't see any evidence of that going on. As a matter of fact, there's, as I said, there's still a lot of money sitting, a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines that has not come into the market, that is kind of earmarked for, if I feel safe about the market, I'll invest this money. So this is not a major event that's going on. It is something that in a normal market occurs as often as a couple of times a year easily, even if we go down 10%. The fact that it's been well over a year since the last time we had a market downturn of 5% means it's going to look a little odd, but this is nothing to worry about. Among other things, when we look at the underlying economy, the thing that ultimately will generate a major bear market is the economy starts to slow down. And the way you know you're going to have a bad bear market is when the economy slows down and for six more months, the stock market does a Wile E. Coyote number. For those of you who are not familiar with Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote is long in the habit of running along the top of a mesa at high speed and keeps on running after he runs out of mesa. And he glances down and realizes there's nothing holding him up, and he smacks into the ground.
There's an obligatory sign that says yipe at that point.
Okay.
You got to hold up the sign that says yipe.
Well, we can look down beneath the market's feet, and we can see solid mesa down there, solid rock. So there's really nothing too big, nothing to be concerned about. The leading economic indicators, and there's several different indices of leading economic indicators, but there's one that comes out every week that's tracked by economy.com, Mark Zandi's group, and they report on it every week, and it will give us, historically has always given us, at least 6 months warning before a recession. Now, sometimes any of these indices of leading economic indicators will warn of a recession, and we don't get one. But since we've had the indices, which goes back into the 1950s, we have never, we've never had a recession that they didn't warn about. So they're not warning. It's kind of like seeing a thunderstorm come ashore or coming in and thinking, oh no, it's a hurricane. It's going to wipe out the entire coast, and with the barometer still high. As long as the barometer is high, you can't have a hurricane. And as long as the leading economic indicators are saying the economy's in good shape, you can't have a major bear market. You know, we can have some very short-term bear market. I'll give you an example. North Korea could launch a nuclear-tipped ICBM and detonate it over the western United States someplace. We could have a major earthquake in California, which eventually is going to happen. It's just a matter of when. So these are called exogenic events. But it's not going to take long under those circumstances to realize that those events, as devastating as they may be, would actually be good for U.S. economy. It'd be good for U.S. Corporations. So these are very short-term events. Now, that doesn't mean we can't get something like 1987. The market did drop about 20% in one day because people were just messing around with being very short-sighted about their investing. But it was back pretty quickly, and that was really just a very, very, very major correction rather than a bear market. It was a really scary one, though. I remember it entirely too well. It got everybody's attention. And we missed last year. It's the first time we've had a year in I don't know how long, 40 years or something, that ended in a 7, where we didn't have a major market correction. Now, I'll tell you.
You know my opinion on that.
What?
Luck. We just happened to have it happen every 10 years. There was some kind of a major market event. But that doesn't mean that it has anything to do with a year ending in a 7. It's just that's when it happened to happen.
Yeah, and I think, very frankly, the second half of the year, the second half of 2018, is when I would expect we have a reasonable, I guess opportunity may not be the right word, but there's a reasonable probability that we could have, I was thinking a major correction would occur probably in October this year. Now, is that a certainty? No. But my reasoning is pretty simple. The last time we had a major tax reform was 1986, and it took effect in 1987. And
October is when it hit.
It hit. You know,
the exuberance kind of wore out. And this is interesting. What could cause a recession or a hurt to the economy right now? We're looking at the leading indicators. Things look really, really good. We're looking ahead. We don't see a cause for this, but there are some things that are dangers. Yesterday, Prime Minister Trudeau from Canada threatened to walk out of the NAFTA renegotiations because what we are proposing in our renegotiation isn't free trade. It's basically it's America first. You've got to bow down to our wishes. That's not good for trading partners. If you have a business partner and you have had a 50-50 deal with them in the past and you say, I'm going to renegotiate that, even if you deserve it, it's not a nice thing for the other partner, and they may just decide to go into business on their own if it's a business partner. And we're talking about Canada now. Canada is a business partner, a trading partner. Mexico is a trading partner. We have had good deals with them in the past, but they have both entered into a big trading block that they don't need us anymore for us to come into it with.
I wouldn't say they don't forcefully need us. I would say that we're no longer absolutely necessary for their survival.
Right, and that's what I mean by need. I mean, we are a major contributor to their well-being, but they don't need us anymore. And as long as we come at it from the position of you need us, then they're going to say, well, no, we don't. It's kind of the Brexit Europe thing where the British are saying to the European Union, you need us, and the European Union saying, no, we don't. And that's part of the reason why those negotiations are not going well.
There's a couple of studies, by the way, that came out on that. And it's starting to actually hit home in the British economy that Britain will be far less well off.
Yeah. And a lot of the companies that were based there are leaving at this point.
And the standards of living will decline. They're basically doing the equivalent of dropping out of NAFTA, only a little more extreme, by dropping out of the European Union. Every indicator right now suggests that they're going to pay a very, very high price for that. And that this is the irony. The people who voted for Brexit tended to be the working class people in Great Britain. In the United Kingdom.
I'm gonna assume that there are people listening that don't know what we're talking about real quick. Let me throw in the backstory. Great Britain, the United Kingdom, is part of the European Union. They don't use the same currency. They're not part of the Eurozone. They don't use the euro. They use the pound. They never switched over, which was probably very good for them. But it's a big free trade zone. Just like the United States, we don't have tariffs when you buy something across state lines here. If you're buying on Amazon, it could be just about anywhere. You're going to pay taxes as if you're buying it here. That was the case in the European Union. Great Britain is leaving. A lot of you know that already. That's what we're talking about with Brexit. That's what's going on. There's kind of a divorce in that free trade block. Go ahead.
But the point is that if I were to line up the people and compare them from one nation to another, and that doesn't work real well because class divisions in the United Kingdom are really real and
yeah.
They're big.
They're named classes. It's not just kind of middle-ish and upper-ish. It's nobility and not nobility.
But roughly the same section of the demographic that voted for Donald Trump, voted for Brexit, voted to leave the common market, and resulted in a Tory, which is a conservative prime minister, May, taking over. And they're proceeding forward with this disengage, get out of this free trade agreement with Europe. And their deepest concern was immigration. There were people coming into the United Kingdom that didn't look like the British, and they didn't sound like the British, and they had other cultures.
And there have been some real immigration issues in France and in other areas. So
you know,
they didn't want the same immigration problems that they're seeing in the rest of Europe.
And so you've got very much the same thing going on there that's going on here. The difference is, and the negotiations are on the way, the difference is there is a date, a very specific date in 2019, I think it's March, about a year from now, when the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. It's as if NAFTA had a drop-dead date, which it doesn't, and says on this date NAFTA ceases to exist, and whatever you negotiate for replacement can replace it, but it's just going to exist because we voted to. It's as if the United States voted to shut down NAFTA completely on a given date, and we're negotiating about it and getting nowhere, and it looks like all of a sudden free trade with Mexico and Canada will suddenly cease to exist. Now, we have no idea what's going to come out of the NAFTA discussions, but we can pretty well see what's going to come out of at least part of the Brexit discussions, and it is not pretty. It's going to cause, and this is the irony, the people it will impact the hardest are the people who voted for it. They are that's where the job losses are already starting to accrue.
Let me come at this with some history, because history's kind of important. It's the only thing that we have for a predictor going forward. We look at patterns in history. Countries that are open to trade with other countries tend to do better over time. And you can look throughout history for this. Countries that are less likely to trade with other countries are countries that are less likely to do well. And we can look at that very directly. There's an easy representation of that when we look at North Korea. North Korea would like to trade with other countries, but the rest of the world is saying, no, we're not going to trade with you. And what has that done to the economy of North Korea? It's not good. We wouldn't normally say in the United States that we would voluntarily do that to ourselves. But that's a part of the feeling that we're pushing into with the renegotiation of NAFTA and the stepping out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's the same thing that's happening in the United Kingdom as they leave the Eurozone. There's a feeling like we're not supporting local trade. So let's kind of fill that in from the kind of the basics. Are you okay with this?
Sure.
You know, the buy local movements, they're great because they support the local business. It allows the local businesses to do well. So if we look at it at a community level, it's a bit easier to understand. If the buy local movement gets so strong as to say, if you don't buy local and we find out about it, we're going to fine you. We're going to charge you money, and the money will go into the coffers of the local government. Well, then people would be less likely to buy local. Think about that for just a second. If you live in Killeen or in Temple, if you live in Dallas or in Boston, if the local government is saying, buy local, it's great, you may be more likely to buy local. If the United States says, hey, buy from the USA, I agree with that wholeheartedly, let's do it. If they come in and say, you live in Boston and you just bought something from Texas, therefore, we're going to put an extra tax, not just the tax you would normally pay. We're going to put an extra tax on that. It causes people to leave Boston. Now, if Texas were to do it, then it would cause trade in Texas to start falling apart, because the economy really does well when there's no added friction to trade. It feels good to say buy local. And it's encouraged. I encourage it. I want to buy from the United States. But if a United States product is not as high a quality as another product, and it's more expensive, I'm probably going to buy the other product. And we see that in Amazon purchases. We see that in Walmart purchases. We see that across the board. People look at quality. People look at price. And they're going to buy based on price and quality. There's a tendency going back to the beginning of mankind. For if a lot of higher quality, lower price stuff is available from everywhere else, to just tack on some higher price to it, to charge more for those items, that's not good throughout history for the location that's doing it, any more than it would be good for Boston or Texas or Austin or Dallas or any of those places to say, if you don't buy from here, we're going to charge you money. And that's what we're doing by stepping away from free trade. It isn't that there's some political agenda behind it. It's that the best competition, you know, we're capitalists in the United States. There's a lot of socialist countries out there. If we don't believe that we can compete on the open market for quality and price, then we shouldn't be in the competition. We shouldn't withdraw ourselves in a way and just tack extra money on everything else, because that doesn't help the businesses either. The government doesn't turn around and give that money to a business to say, here, have this. We took this from your competitor. They just take it from the competitor, which causes all the prices to come up. It's a big thing that causes inflation. The Smoot-Hawley Act in the 1930s very clearly led to a worsening of a recession into the Great Depression, because we slapped a lot of tariffs on foreign nations. Those tariffs led in large part to us being attacked by Japan. That surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, to the Japanese, they felt like we had attacked them with trade. And for those of us in the United States, most of us don't see trade as a war type tactic, except that when we use tariffs and we just call it a different word, we call it sanctions against North Korea, it is one step away from an armed response. It's what we did to Germany after World War I. That led to World War II. After World War II, we didn't slap a bunch of tariffs on Germany. We allowed them to grow their economy on an equal footing. We had a lot of input into that equal footing, and we have two great allies that have come out of it, except that if we're not careful, we may go right back to slapping tariffs on these great allies and they won't be allies anymore. That's kind of my basics from the ground up. Buy local is an important and encouraged item, but buy local or else doesn't work.
Well, fundamentally, to go back to economics, the United States is very nearly at full employment.
Yeah.
Now, when I say very nearly at full employment, technically, our unemployment rate is 4.1%, but there's economists, serious economists, who are beginning to question that number. And we question that number because there are, if you add up since we've been in the 4% range, the number of people who have been hired, the net number of new jobs that have been filled, we basically have boiled through all of the people who are unemployed and then some. Which indicates that there's more unemployed people if you want to truly count unemployment. And I don't mean the U3, which is the people who are looking for work, but they're discouraged. Apparently, there's another pool of people out there, and this is not the first time in the history of the country this has happened. Following recessions, it happens that there's this pool of people who really don't have to work. And it might be a husband or a wife where their spouse is employed full-time and they're just not real sure they want to be employed as well. And we know people in that condition. If the right job came along with the right location and the right conditions, they would go to work. Now, this is an interesting point. In the criteria they list for why what would make them go from not even looking for work, not even considering it, to taking a job, wages are not listed in their priorities because they have enough money. The issue is, if there were a job that was interesting, that would fill their time up nicely, that would make them feel productive, and also, of course, would pay them something, they would probably take the job. And there's a lot of suspicion right now that that's what's happening in the economy, is we have this people coming out of this dark pool of unemployed people who are not reporting that they're looking for work because they're not. The work finds them rather than them finding the work. And they go to work and they don't demand a raise over what other people are making. Therefore, the price of the wages don't go up. They fill a slot that a business needs filled. And they enter the workforce and go about their business. Good for the economy. But that explains why, A, we've not had inflation. And, B, we are not seeing wages go up. One of the things that has to happen for inflation to take off is you get a wage spiral, meaning businesses start competing for employees, and they compete by raising the wages they offer for a given job. That hasn't happened. And so one of the mysteries appears to be resolving itself in the United States economy. As the news reported, if you were listening to the news before this program, wages have risen year over year 2.9%. That was the latest as of the end of December. That is much higher than we've seen in the past. We've seen in the 2% range, maybe up to 2.5%. This is the first 2.9% we've seen in a long time, which indicates that that dark pool of employees may be getting a little short, a little shallow, and we're starting to get wage rises that are coming along because of a shortage of workers. And that will generate inflation, which will cause the Fed to raise interest rates, which will cause interest rates across the board to go up. And that has a lot of ramifications, but not playing commercials also has a lot of ramifications. So we need to play some commercials.
Yes. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. If you'd like to join our conversation in here, the phone number to join us is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I wanted to note for posterity, as we were going out of here, you said Jake and I said Jeff, and I think that is the first time.
Yeah, it could be. What, the you asked for
years?
It last week.
I did.
We didn't even stumble on it, so it's interesting.
I was really impressed, but it needs to be noted down for the posterior.
You can write it on your posterior if you want.
Or posterity or something like
that.
Yeah,
I think that's the right word.
Anyway, lots of numbers that I think are pretty interesting going on out there. We're ramping up oil production in the United States very nicely. The inventories are coming up, which means probably the price of oil will be coming down in the near future. Manufacturing orders and actual shipments continue to rise, which is a really good thing for the economy. And, of course, the headline news this week, that the Labor Department, on its first estimate of employment for last month, we added 200,000 jobs to the economy. And I think they're going to probably revise that upward as time goes by. But anything above, about 144, 150?
Yeah, about 150. That's a nice round number to say.
Is more people being hired.
That's 150,000, by the
right.
way. We're not just 150. If the country's only hiring 150 people, we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. So if you take all the layoffs and firings and you subtract them from all the hirings last month or in December, and you seasonally adjust it, by the way, because
yeah.
it's Christmas.
I seasonally adjust a lot of things around Christmas. I put nutmeg in it.
Right.
But
anyway,
seasonally adjusted.
We have in other words, there were roughly 50,000 to 60,000 more people hired than came into the workforce, theoretically. Now, in fact, like I said earlier, I think there are some people coming into the workforce that are coming in below the radar. But every indication that we see out there says the United States economy is on a roll, it has momentum, and it's picking up speed.
Right.
Now, before you credit this to the wrong place too much,
basically any credit to the political anything is wrong. Nothing. It doesn't matter if it was Obama or Trump or Bush or Clinton or the president doesn't affect the economy.
I'm in no way, by the way, suggesting that that this is criticism of President Trump. However, I do want to point out that the economic recovery and now expansion that we're in has to be set up 3 or 4 years in advance.
Yeah, absolutely.
The groundwork is either laid for a major expansion or a contraction years before it happens. It's not something that happens instantaneously.
And that groundwork is almost never done by the political machine of Washington, whether that's presidential or congressional or court-related. They can have an effect, but the groundwork has to be laid by businesses and by workers. That's the only way it works.
And I'll also say that some of the more astute minds in long-term investing are also sounding the alarm that the tax bill that our Congress passed this year or last year and went into effect just before the beginning of the year is quite possibly laying the groundwork for an economic calamity 5 to 7 years from now. And that's just something that you need to be aware of. That
this came out from the Congressional Budget Office. They expect this year, this is a year when we're getting a lot of boosts from money being taxed overseas. This isn't repatriation, by the way. Folks you that listen to this, repatriation means bring the money back and pay the tax. Doesn't matter where it is, the tax is getting paid, so you might as well bring it back anyway.
Except that notably companies are not bringing it back very fast.
Right, and there are some that are, there are some that aren't, but there's taxes being paid on all those assets that are overseas if it's a company based in the United States. Now it's being paid at a lower rate, which is great. We say that's great. All right, we've got taxes coming in. We still expect this year, this is an estimate, but it's a pretty accurate estimate, give or take $50 billion, which to most people is a lot of money, to the government not. We're going to have a deficit this year somewhere approaching $1 trillion, which is roughly double what it was last year. And this is due to the tax cut. It's just a simple statement of this, we're getting less revenue in. The Republicans say it's going to take some time for the economy to build based on the lower taxes, and that may be the case, but any way you look at it, we're taking on $500 billion more than we did last year in debt for the U.S. government. That's got to be paid back sometime.
And
That's bigger than what we spent on TARP, by the way. That's the size of the biggest stimulus package that we did during the Great Recession is the deficit spending, additional deficit spending that we'll be doing this year. So the Republicans that were against TARP because they saw it as a bailout, it's the same kind of bailout to do this kind of taxation at this point. I'm not against it or for it. I am saying that when people's definitions differ on things that are essentially the same thing, then they're politically motivated rather than rational thinkers. So look at this as it is. We've got this great benefit of lower taxes this year to citizens. Just realize that the piper's got to get paid. The government is taking on debt to give us back the tax money. That's not a long-term sustainable solution.
And there's J.P. Morgan came out with a position paper, and their economists have generally been right. They're still in business, which is a powerful indication they've been right. And they have suggested that the stock market will be unaffected by the tax cut, which was a bit of a surprise for a lot of people. The reason, they said, is that the additional deficits, which, by the way, were announced officially by the Treasury this week, which is why interest rates jumped and at least supposedly why the market plunged, is because the deficit, the Treasury came out and said, guess what, in the next quarter, we're going to be borrowing. Actually, they said we're going to be issuing bonds, but that's the same thing as borrowing. We're going to be borrowing a lot more money than we borrowed in the first quarter last year, and we anticipate that we'll be borrowing a lot more money in the second, third, and fourth quarters. As Jake said, basically the Treasury has come out and warned we need to borrow about $500 billion more than we did last year.
So come up all the way up to $950 billion to $1 trillion. That's the expected deficit this year.
And
this is what we were paying in the middle of the recession when revenues were down. We were borrowing in the middle of the recession. That's a problem.
What J.P. Morgan has said, and it's twofold. One, we're near full employment, and that means that if you stimulate businesses by allowing them to have, and this is the big thing, not the tax cut, the instant write-off for any new purchases.
Right.
You give them a big tax break, they're going to hire more people. But the problem with hiring more people,
there's not a lot of people left to hire, so you have to pay a lot more wages.
That's going
to
run the wages up. And the second thing is the additional
people
borrowing.
People say, what's wrong with that?
When the borrowing hits the market, that's going to raise interest rates too. So what J.P. Morgan is saying is that as an economy, the tax cuts will not show up because they will be offset by increased interest payments. And so the net return will be effectively zero on cash flow. Now, short term,
it's great.
Next
boon.
Year or so, we're already starting to see long-term capital investments and goods shoot upward pretty much at the maximum rate that they can, given the constraints we have on the ability to build things.
Right. And some of you out there are hearing us being negative. It's kind of funny because some of you out there are hearing us being positive. These are the same words that we're saying. And I know this because I get feedback. And when we talk about trade and not being in the trade, when we talk about what could be a problem in the future, people hear us talking about problems. But we have a precursor on that to say all of the pieces of the economy are running great at the moment. Our job, as we see it, as economists, as advisors, is to look at right now, look at where we've been, and then look at what we expect the actions that we're taking right now to lead to in the future. So we can say we can take advantage of this good time right now. Just prepare yourself, because this is not the way it's going to be forever.
Now, short term, we make some... We're making a prediction that there's going to be some kind of crisis coming up because of the fiscal policy of the government. We're also
pretty far out there, though.
Well,
years, not this year, probably.
Right. To give you an example of our accuracy, we were when we first started saying that Bitcoin was due for a crash. That's when everybody was saying Bitcoin. This could go on forever. This is wonderful. Just for the record, in case, because it doesn't make the headlines as much, Bitcoin at the beginning of this year was trading around $20,000.
No, it was the beginning of December of last year. It was at 20,000.
Okay, it was in December, but
that's when the big crash happened. Is the end of December, and now we've had further crashes through January.
It hit, I think, on Friday. It was down to $7,600. It bumped up into the 8,000 range just before I stopped gathering data at the end of the day yesterday. But basically it's fallen 60% in a month.
That's not the only time it's done it. It's just the only time it's not the biggest. There were some times just 4 years ago that it was down 70%.
Oh, okay.
But the thing is, there were very, very few people even aware of it a few years ago. Now there's a lot of money from the general public that's poured into it. So it's much more on the radar. It's much more seen.
Which reminds me, one of the questions that's being raised by people who believe in blockchain as a currency generator is there's so many different cryptocurrencies out there now. Which one will survive? Which one will become the dominant one, if any?
Venezuela's coming out with a petrocurrency, by the way. The U.S. government has just warned everyone that if you participate in the initial coin offering for Petro, which is the Venezuelan new cryptocurrency, that you will be violating the State Department's sanctions on Venezuela.
Well, the reason that I bring this up, you may very well be tempted at some point. There was about $600 million that was frozen by the Securities and Exchange Commission because of a fraudulent coin offering. And that $600 million, now, when I say frozen, the company was frozen. That's not to say that the SEC actually filed a motion in court to freeze the actual money. That's not to say that they'll actually recover the money. But that's about $600 million, mostly from small investors, into a Bitcoin copy. There was another half a $1 billion that disappeared from an exchange.
$650 million worth of a cryptocurrency in Japan that just got hacked away, that showed up probably in the coffers of North Korea. Just as a side note, this is cool for you to know as well. The U.S. government is really upset because North Korea has been trading with other nations, and they're supposed to not do that. These are nations that they're trading with that they are not supposed to be trading with. Those nations have agreed not to trade with them, but they're doing it anyway. China, Russia, Syria. They estimate that North Korea has made about $200 million. That's with an M, which is not normally a number that's used when talking about company or countries' economies. But $200 million was made by North Korea, which is a lot of money for a corporation, not usually for a company.
Not usually for a country.
But the $650 million cryptocurrency hacking in Japan, if you just look at the North Korean suspected, and by suspected, it's a very strong suspicion, hacking that's taken place, it's about 12 times the sanction violations that they're doing with other trade. So cryptocurrencies are feeding the rogue nations out there. They're swooping in. Stanford did a study where 10% of the assets that have gone into cryptocurrencies have disappeared through hacking theft. 10%. I mean, that's, you've got to have a better than that return right away. And if you're one of the ones that was hacked, you get 100% loss. So I just wanted to throw those out there. It's important to recognize it's dangerous. It's easier for people to believe us now that it's dropped 60% over a month. That doesn't mean that you should get complacent.
And I just, it's just a fair warning that if you put money into cryptocurrencies, the odds are you just need to wave goodbye to it at this point. The smaller and less sophisticated the investor, unless you are a hacker yourself with a lot of money and a lot of sophistication, odds are if you get an invitation to invest in cryptocurrencies and you do so, pretty fair chance you just get a chance to say goodbye to that money. And maybe some other money, too, if you give them your bank account number.
Now, we're getting close to being out of time for this hour. We've got another hour coming up. We've talked a lot about the jobs reports that's come out. We haven't really gone into the fact that wages had a big jump up.
I mentioned the fact we had almost a 3%.
Right.
Well, actually, if you use the PCE core deflator, which is what the Federal Reserve does.
It sounds like we just started speaking
personal
Greek.
Consumption expenditures, use that as a deflator, and it's basically the core inflation rate that the Federal Reserve uses to figure out whether we've got actually any inflation. That was,
right.
Wages were up 2.9, but the inflation rate year over year as of the end of January, at the end of December, was 1.9%.
Which means that people had a raise. The wages went up higher than inflation, which is excellent. The problem is that it tends to lead to more inflation later.
But the Federal Reserve's goal was 2%, and they're getting very close to that 2%, which means that they will begin, if they haven't already, unloading money from their balance sheet and raising interest rates.
Right. And we are out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice to people with large portfolios and, in some cases, smaller portfolios. If you'd like to call us off the air, we've got voicemail waiting all weekend long and real live people during the week, during business hours. The number to call locally is?
Area code 254, of course, 947-1111. That's 947-1111.
You can reach that number toll free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. If you would like to email us directly, we do read our email. It's amazing. It's at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter, read about our philosophy, how we do business. You can listen to podcasts of this program and many others going into the past. Check to see what we've been saying and how right we are or wrong we are. Challenge us on it. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.